Good afternoon, Sonoma County and the world. The time is 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS-LP Cows Radio. Broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm, bringing you the Mystical Positivist for the next 2 hours. Cows Community Radio thanks Minnie Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Minnie Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Minnie Rivers carries fine loose leaf teas and teaware. They also host spiritual talks and classes. Minnie Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. You can phone them at area code 707-829-8871 or visit them on the web at www.minnieriversbooks.com. Cows Community Radio has a new fundraising effort called GivePlace. GivePlace is an online marketplace where you can sell, donate, or buy items. Everything sold on GivePlace gives 10% to 100% of its proceeds to your favorite local nonprofit organization. You can also support Cows Radio by buying and selling on GivePlace. Go to www.giveplace.com. Cows Community Radio is membership supported, so we would appreciate all the support that you can provide this station in the form of donations and volunteer work. Go to www.kows.fm to find out ways in which you can help keep originally sourced West Sonoma County radio on the air. This week on The Mystical Positivist, our guest by telephone is Swami Kecharanata, a teacher and leader of a community of spiritual practitioners at Sacred Space Yoga Sanctuary. He is a disciple of the revered Swami Rudrananda in the lineage of Kashmir Shaivite spiritual practice. In addition to teaching, Swami Kecharanata also serves as director of Rudra Mandir, a center for spirituality and teaching, which is operated by Sacred Space. We'll get started with all that after a short musical break. We'll be listening to Gayatri from the CD Ravi Shankar, Chants of India, produced by George Harrison.
Prachodayat.
This is the Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. I'm your host, Stuart Gudnick, the Mystical Positivist. Joining me in the studio is my co-host, Dr. Robert Schmidt. Rob is the director of Tayu Meditation Center and founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol, California.
It's great to be here.
This week our guest by telephone is Swami Kecharanatha, a teacher and leader of a community of spiritual practitioners at Sacred Space Yoga Sanctuary. He is a disciple of the revered Swami Rudrananda in a lineage of Kashmir Shaivite spiritual practice. In addition to teaching, Swami Kecharanatha also serves as director of Rudra Mandir, a center for spirituality and teaching, which is operated by Sacred Space. Also known as Nataji, he has been teaching Kundalini Mahayoga since 1972. With a mastery etched from 4 decades of inner practice and selfless service, he is an authentic adept of Tantric Shaivism and an initiated carrier in the Shaktipat lineage of Bhagavan Nityananda and Swami Rudrananda, that is, Swami Rudi. Swami Kecharanatha's books include Depth Over Time, Kundalini Mahayoga, A Path of Transformation, Merging with the Divine, and One Day at a Time. Those titles plus guided meditation CDs can be purchased at his website, swamikacharanatha.com. Nataji, welcome to the Mystical Positivist.
Thank you. Glad to be there.
Excellent. Well, our custom is to start these interviews with a question about spiritual background. We all started off as kids, and in many cases, there were formative experiences someplace along the line that, in retrospect, we can point to and say those were that took me in the path that led to the practice that I have become known for. And so my question to you is: tell us about your spiritual background. Tell us about your impressions growing up, and what led you to the practice that you and the tradition that you work in now.
You know, it's interesting because I get a question like that similar, and I always talk about my life as BR and AR, before Rudy and after Rudy. I met Rudy when I was about 20 years old. Just came out of the lovely 60s area, and met him when I was about 20. And I have to say that really before my meeting of him, I didn't really grow up in any kind of religious or spiritual environment. My parents were Methodist, but not particularly religious or dedicated to that practice. So I didn't really have my upbringing wasn't involved in with religion or spiritual practice. And
didn't you write on one of the things I read on your website that in fact you were even an atheist as a teenager?
Yeah, you know, as a teenager, then we're always trying to create identity for ourselves, and so at some point I kind of adopted that idea of being an atheist I reflect on it once, I reflected it wasn't really particularly that I believed that so much as it was a different belief than my parents.
Right.
But I basically didn't really have a sense of God or, you know, any sense of there being a source of life that was different than just being alive. So in that sense, I called myself an atheist, yeah.
Got it. And then on your website you say something like then at 19 suddenly you became God obsessed. How did that happen?
Going through all the what we thought were going to be all the highs of our drug use, I went through all the lows of my drug use, and one evening found myself in a pretty desperate situation, and something with some interesting options that I was considering, and something just said, "You got to understand, there's something more to this." Mm. And the really interesting thing that around that was that I was living in West Texas at the time, a place called Odessa, and a friend of mine who was actually living in the house with me went from West Texas to East Texas to a place called Denton outside of Dallas. And he was supposed to be doing some business there for us. And when he came back, he told me that he met this man, large, heavy-set, bald-headed man. He went to this class with him, and there was this tremendous energy in the room, and people were having, you know, of course, what we'll call kriyas. At the time, he didn't really know the name of it. And when he told me, you know, it kind of said, oh, that's interesting. And nothing really happened. You know, there was no, like, big light went off or anything. But within about a week, I woke up one morning, and as I said in my book, all I could think about was God. And I became a vegetarian. And I grew up on meat and potatoes and corn if I really was forced. to eat another vegetable. I started doing hatha yoga about 4 hours a day. I stopped doing drugs. I felt God in my life and in a sense for no good reason. And it was kind of from that point that about 9 months later that I ended up meeting Rudy. I was living in West Texas. After this experience, I said, okay, I've had enough fun being in West Texas. And I went to Colorado. And without a doubt, every week after I got to Colorado, I would meet somebody from Indiana. And every one of them were telling me how incredible Indiana was. Well, my question to them always was, well, why are you living here? Well, you know, we wanted something different, et cetera. So after about 12 months of being in Colorado, I decided to go to Indiana. I went to Indiana. 3 days after I arrived in Indiana, I was walking down the street, and I looked up, and I saw this poster, and there's this very large, bald-headed man with his blazing eyes, and I looked at the photo, and I said, oh, that's who my friend was talking about. I didn't know the name. He didn't remember the person's name. But as soon as I saw the photo, I knew that's who he was talking about. And the next night, I went to a lecture by Rudy. And the next day, I went to class. And about 3 weeks later, I moved in his ashram. So it was almost like my friend had carried the seed of that connection, you know, to me. And so it took this circuitous route of about 9 months from Texas to Colorado to Indiana before I actually met Rudy. And the moment I saw him in that lecture, then I knew, one, that's who my friend had talked about, but I knew this was my teacher and that he was going to take me to God.
So when you described that it was grace that turned you towards God, in a sense, from what I'm hearing is that it was the Guru's grace all along, in the sense that the seed after that seed was delivered, this transformation occurred in your life.
Yes, exactly, because it was, you know, that seed was delivered, and you know, when grace becomes active in you, when it starts to call you, if you will, then, you know, it just calls you, and it takes you a little while to hear it, but it was really just that calling, that inner seed growing, and that energy field of Rudy, you know, in a sense, attracting me, magnetizing me, you know, to that situation, yeah.
Great. So then you were living on that ashram for how long? Where you'd met Rudy?
I met Rudy in 1972, the fall of 1972, and I moved into the ashram again just a few months after that. And the ashram was in Indiana at the time. Rudy lived in New York City, and he would come to Indiana every 5-6 weeks to teach. And so as he came, then I became close with him in the sense that I was dedicated to that practice and him. And, within about 6 months after I started practice with him, he made me a teacher. And I started my own ashram, in Lafayette, Indiana. The ashram was originally in Bloomington, Indiana. And I lived there, ran that ashram for a while. Rudy actually passed the samadhi in February 1973. And so I only really knew him for about 18 months physically in my life. And after he passed, within about a couple of years after he passed, then there were a number of ashrams around the Midwest, and there was a decision to consolidate them all back into Bloomington. So the ashram that I lived in Bloomington, was from the early 70s to about 1982, when we decided to actually move the ashram to Boston, Massachusetts, in Cambridge. And that ashram was there. We were intending to buy a large facility building and, was never able to find one that we could afford. So we had 5 or 6 houses. Instead, and then in 1992, I believe we ended up moving the entire ashram to Portland, Oregon. We had found a beautiful old facility there that we made into the ashram. And I lived there until 2001 when I moved to Berkeley. So I lived in the ashram for about 30 years.
So I'm interested in the speed with which you were designated as a teacher, in that I presume, even in your own tradition, that that's somewhat unusual. And I'm curious what your reflections now on that are. Were you, you know, particularly precocious spiritually in one sense, or was it in a sense Rudy's way to pull something out of you much faster because of his impending Mahasamadhi?
Well, I think a little bit of both. Rudy made a number of people teachers, and I believe that while we weren't really, didn't have the maturity and didn't have the length of training that one might think you would have, I believe that it was he felt he was not going to live that much longer. He kept telling he was going to die when he was 56. He actually died when he was 45. But I've come to understand that was just smokescreen, because if he had started really telling us, I'm really going to die when I'm 45, we would have all clamped onto him so hard that he wouldn't have been able to get out. And so I think his really was a powerfully powerful person, and I think it was a little bit Johnny Appleseed. I think he planted a lot of seeds because he felt he wasn't going to be around a lot, and he felt an obligation to our lineage and wanted, so he threw the seeds out there, he watered them, he nourished them, and I think was, you know, we'll see who actually just sticks in and grows roots and and the whole situation grows. And I think, I mean, did he see some potential in me that, you know, obviously he must, but Rudy believed in the ultimate potential in every person. And so I don't think it was because, oh, this person's special, that person's not, that he did that. I'm sure each person was considered by him to be initiated as a teacher, then he considered, can this person really carry this? Will they develop the capacity and the maturity and the commitment to carry it forth? But at the same time, he was profoundly detached because he knew this was not, he didn't own anything. He was simply a conduit and was his responsibility to pass it on. And I think that was really the approach that he took.
Got it. So I'm interested then in, I mean, you describe a situation which, you know, happens in other communities, spiritual communities too, sometimes where, you know, there's a crop of people who are given this hot potato, as it were. That's the
right
term we use in our tradition, and then you have to see what they do with it. What was your experience over the subsequent? I mean, let's just for the sake of argument, you lived in the ashram for 30 years. During that 30 years, what did you do with your hot potato or that hot potato?
Well, the person who was in charge of that ashram is a man named Swami Chaitanananda who still teaches, lives in Portland. So he was the Swami. He was the carrier of the lineage, at least this branch of the lineage. And I was the head teacher there. And so mostly what I did was serve him and serve the community as a way of cultivating and nourishing that seed that Rudy put in me, you know, when he was alive, and that he had empowered me to try to grow within myself. So I spent the 30 years living in the ashram and was completely dedicated to that situation. And that was really the soil that I grew the hot potato in.
Got it. So it was the nourishment of your own service to Chaitanananda and the community.
Yes, combined with, of course, the nourishment of the grace and the energy of the Shaktipat from Chaitanananda. He was, you know, he was my teacher after Rudy died, and so then I received tremendous amounts from him, you know, from a transmission point of view.
Sure.
And that's always that nourishment can only be really saturate and provide growth for us if we respond to it in kind, with service and dedication.
Got it. So, would you also identify direct Shaktipat from Rudy after his Mahasamadhi as well as part of your process?
Yes. You know, when Rudy passed, Rudy died in a light plane accident. He was flying from New York City to upstate New York, you know, a 5-hour drive or 45-minute plane ride. And he crashed into the side of a mountain. They got fogged in, and he crashed into the side of a mountain. And there were four people in the plane. And the plane was just destroyed, just, you know, a bunch of little pieces. And the amazing thing is the other three people basically walked off the mountain the next morning because they couldn't see, but hardly with scratches on them. Rudy died, and he died of, there was a huge cavity from inside his body. I think he left his body with such force that he just, you know, opened that whole system up.
Wow.
you know, in burying him, he was created, but, you know, seeing his body was, it was not Rudy in the sense that it was, that was just a physical body. And there was never one second, of any difference of the energy field that I felt that was him. And that in fact, well, I would say there was about 3 minutes that I couldn't feel Rudy, and that was the 3 minutes after we got the phone call that it was confirmed that he had passed. And that 3 minutes was, wasn't that he went away, and I went away. The contraction that happened, you know, was intense, of course, mm-hmm. as you would understand. But amazingly enough, and I only credit this to Grace again, about 3 minutes into the experience, something in me said, wait a minute, this is your teacher's freedom. This is what he spent his life and lifetimes trying to accomplish. Why should you be unhappy, right? And it of course, it just changed the whole experience for me. And after that, you know, I've always said Rudy gave us two great gifts, and that was one, letting us know him, and the other was dying, because the experience, the amount of work that it took to really understand non-duality based on that experience of our teacher dying, and yet that energy field still being there, really was one of the profound experiences of my life, even as I was 22 or something at the time, in a sense, because Rudy's body was no longer there. You know, he was no longer working any store, and you couldn't call him on the phone, and yet there was this profound presence, and that presence only grew over time, more and more time, after he had passed. And I will say also that was always very strong, but particularly the last 10 or 12 years after I moved out of the ashram and moved to Berkeley and started my own center, that presence has even manifested further. But it never, it's so through the whole course, it's never gone away. And you know, anytime I want to call on him, the energy is there.
Got it. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I are speaking this week with our guest by telephone, Swami Kacharanata, a teacher and leader of a community of spiritual practitioners at Sacred Space Yoga Sanctuary. He is a disciple of the revered Swami Rudrananda and serves as director of Rudra Mandir in Berkeley, California, a center for spirituality and teaching.
So just to continue with what you were talking about before this brief break, I want to just talk about your understanding and your experience of lineage. You've already really talked about that pretty profoundly here, but I just want to sort of put it in that context of lineage. And on your website, you have there's a nice quote about it. You write, "A lineage is an unbroken transmission of a living spiritual force that is passed from heart to heart. It flows from one generation to the next, from a teacher to the student he wishes to initiate as a lineage carrier. Whether the initiation is an elaborate ceremony or simply the words of the teacher spoken to the heart of the person being initiated, it's the power of initiation that installs the seed of the living force in the recipient. Although this force manifests within a teacher, this living energy is greater than that which is carried within any person. A lineage carrier serves that force." So maybe you could talk a little bit about what it means to. I mean, it's sort of another manifestation of surrender, if I understand what you mean in that, with those words, which is that you're, by serving the lineage as a carrier, you're connect. Not only are you connecting to the other lineage carriers who preceded you, but you are partaking of something greater than all combined, if you will. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I'd be happy to. I I should interject that our lineage, the if you will, what we would certainly call the root guru of our lineage was a man named Bhagavan Nityananda,
right,
who lived in India, took the Mahasamadhi in 1961, was born around the turn of the century. And Bhagavan Nityananda was then and really still is considered one of the greatest saints of modern India.
Right.
An extraordinary, extraordinary saint and presence. And it was truly, actually remarkable when Rudy met him in 1959. There weren't many people going to India in 1959 to study spiritual work. Rudy describes that as the transformative moment of his life. Of course, he was probably, would have been 35, something like that. Even, I guess, from earlier, or a little earlier, 1959. And he walked into this room, had heard about this, saint. Rudy's background was that his primary teachers up until that point were, he studied with Gurdjieff and Paksu Bud, and then he studied for some time with a man named the Shankaracharya Puri. But mostly he was really on his own, and then when he met Nityananda in 1959, he walked into the room and, you know, of course it was typical India, so it was just a bare room and a couple of bare light bulbs hanging from the ceiling. And from across the room, Nityananda looked at him, their eyes connected, and this incredible force just, you know, transformed him. And he, at that moment, knew this was his teacher, was dedicated to him after that. And a similar experience in the sense that he met Nityananda in 1959. Nityananda took samadhi in 1961. And there's actually unclear stories. Rudy at one point said that was the only time he ever met him. In one other place in one of his books, he said that he saw him three times. In any case, it was not very much, and it would have been, you know, probably for an hour or so, you know, a couple times, you know, whenever he met him. But for Rudy, also, his most profound experience with Nityananda was after Nityananda took samadhi in 1961, and Rudy, until the day he died, would describe these incredible experiences of Nityananda, if you will, consuming him, coming into him. And so Rudy, you know, was very dedicated to that. Rudy actually studied with Swami Muktananda, who was a disciple, of course, of Nityananda's, and was the person who brought Muktananda to the United States, paid for his first world tour. But that, again, similar to my own experience in the sense that was really, he engaged in that relationship with Muktananda in service to his relationship with Nityananda, and in a sense, as kind of a more juice, more electrical current of giving him more energy in order to make deeper contact with that energy field that was coming to him as Nityananda. So, who his teachers were, we don't really know. Some of the clan says, oh, he was an avidute, he didn't need a teacher. There was a man named Shivananda, but not the famous Shivananda that he spent a little time with. So my sense is that, you know, there's always this intrinsic spiritual force, the space of God, of Shiva, if you will, that's looking for an incarnate body to function through. And in a sense, I think a powerful force emerged through Nityananda, and Rudy made contact with that and really consumed it, if you will. And so for me, while I knew Rudy, you know, for a short period of time, and he was my teacher, the strength of the connection with Nityananda is, I would say, equally as strong. You know, often in my meditations or when I'm teaching, then, you know, I feel his presence as much as I do Rudy's. But that a lineage, that's what you're really serving, is this spiritual force that that only has one source, which is God, which is Shiva, and is really that Shakti, which is the expression of that that God consciousness, of Shiva's consciousness. It creates its own channels, and lineage really is that. It's really how the emission of Shiva's consciousness is expressed through human beings. And aren't we incredibly lucky that that's the case?
Thank you. One area I'm interested in is the, I don't know if it's a distinction or maybe it's an elaboration, but in some of your writing, particularly in Depth Over Time, you allude to the relationship of the teacher with the student, and you even go on to quote some of Ken Wilber in terms of the intensity that relationship can have, in the sense that a spiritual teacher is often a very uncomfortable mirror for someone who's seeking to disidentify with mechanical aspects of themselves and open themselves up into their true self. And I guess the distinction I'm interested in is between that model of teaching and a model that you describe where the power of the lineage and the power of the connection with the teacher and the energy link is sufficiently strong that one doesn't even need very much face time in order for this process of transformation to be taking place seemingly almost on its own.
Yeah, and I think that in a sense that's really describing Shaktipat, which means descent of grace, and it's understood and experienced within the tantric tradition that that Shaktipat is the catalyst that creates freedom within a human being. And that descent, so Shaktipat means descent of grace. The most recognized way that that Shaktipat is given, of course, is from a teacher to a student. The highest level of Shaktipat is the direct transmission from Shiva to an individual. And so for when you see great saints, and say a person like Nityananda, who, whether he had a teacher or not is really unclear. If he did, it wasn't for some very long period of time. He was a person that we would certainly describe, we're a little biased, but we would, as a person who received that grace directly from Shiva, it's actually understood to be a transmission through the goddess Kundalini, which is Shiva's vehicle, if you will. And so for a person who has that kind of direct contact, where through all their good works, through their good karma, through all their lifetimes of maturing spiritually, and that's all that's really required of them. And in a sense, it's not all that's required, but that there's a maturity in them that just attracts that. For the rest of the slums in the world, that's probably not really the case. It's, you know, that we have to really do the work to cultivate that inner capacity, that inner discipline, to create the space in ourselves to receive that nourishment, and to receive that nourishment on an extended period of time from our teacher. And Shaktipat means the sense of grace, also is described as transmission of energy. And there are four major ways that transmission happens. One is through the look or the eye. One is through the touch. The other is through the thought, and through word. In Shaktipat is most people understand Shaktipat as a transmission through, you look guru, you know, there's a transmission of energy through the eyes or through the touch. Fewer people understand, or I should say are more willing to understand, that Shaktipat from the teacher through word is equally as powerful, not different. And because if so, then if your teacher is giving you some instruction about some change that you need to make in yourself in order to be more open to receive deeper, that's the power of that transmission trying to create a deeper space in you. The problem is most people want to categorize, well, this is Shaktipat, and oh, that advice that my teacher has given me, that's not right. That I don't agree with that, or that, you know, I don't really want to do that. And so then they're missing the point, in the sense that they're limiting what the power of that instruction. I have to say that one of the things that I worked hardest in my life through with when I was 30 and when I was with Chaitanananda for those 30 years was to receive that instruction, and actually not just to receive it, but to really reach for it, ask for it, because I understood that when that energy is being transmitted, it's reaching the depth of our core. When that energy is being transmitted through instruction, it unfortunately has to go through our own mind, our own perception, our own projections, etc. And being willing to suspend our belief in the sense of what we think we know or what we think we don't know or what's true, what's not true, is that's a big part of really freeing ourselves from the limited capacity of the ego to understand and experience the truth. So from my perspective, even though I'm not, I give people feedback mostly when they ask, I think it's not any less powerful or important than that transmission, which is just, you're sitting with the teacher, there's a transmission happening and no words are really need to be spoken. And that's ultimately certainly the truth. But when the words are spoken, it's important to listen.
So when you use an analogy like the Shaktipat as a catalyst for transformation, my own technical background comes to the fore, and I recognize that a catalyst requires still the presence of certain ingredients for a transformation or a process to complete. So am I understanding you in saying that a Shaktipat is necessary but not sufficient for transformation in a spiritual student? There needs to be some level of engagement or maturation, if you will, on the part of the student to complete that process?
I would say yes, but I think what's really important for this, from the student's perspective, is to, in the receiving of Shaktipat, to allow that vital, that awakening vital force within themselves to show them their own misunderstanding. And that's the power of Shaktipat. It's not transmitting something that's not already in you. It is activating something in you that's ever present. And so, and the power of Kundalini is once it's activated, it, if you will seek its own home. It will seek its own source. Kundalini is understood as Shakti is, and Kundalini is also described as that vital force which is expressing us as individuated expressions of the highest consciousness. And so when you hear Shiva Shakti, when you hear the awakening of Kundalini and the rising of that vital force through the psychic system, back through to the center of the head or the crown, in a sense, it's going back home. And so the surrender is really to the, well, I don't like to use the word so much, is to the process of that. It's really to the power that's been activated in you that was never not within you, and allowing it to transform you. And I think that's really the power of Shaktipat. And in that process, our warts in our misunderstanding are going to get exposed. It has to expose them, because we then have to consciously free ourselves from our own misunderstanding. And that's amazing that we can have this experience where our own limited perspectives are shown to us as limited perspectives. And then that's where the whole importance of surrender and the willingness to be changed is critical, because if we see some limitation in ourselves and we aren't willing to change it, then we limit that opening from taking place.
Got it. So that kind of leads me to want you to speak to the question of just what the Kashmiri Shaivite tradition that you are part of, what those words mean for our listeners who may have little or no understanding of that, and if you could also bring in the word or what you mean by the word Tantra, that would be good, because of course here in the West I think there's a very facile, shallow understanding and misunderstanding of that term. So maybe you could lay a foundation for that,
sure,
for what you understand,
sure,
about that.
Right. The word Tantra, one of the ways that it's a little difficult word to actually translate, but one of the ways it's translated is continuous thread. Hmm. And what it really referring to within the Tantra tradition is the continuous thread of consciousness that pervades and emits, that pervades life and is the source of life. And so Tantric Shaivism is the process of coming in contact with that vital force, that continuous thread that of life, of energy that is source and the form of life. And so that's kind of one of the most simplest ways to try to find the term Tantra. Of course, there are lots of misperceptions of it, but that's just what it is. Tantric Shaivism is basically emerged out of Kashmir Shaivism. So sometimes it's called Kashmir Shaivism, right, which at the time was northern India. Mm-hmm. And it really became prominent in the 8th and 9th century. But you have to understand that the practice of Kundalini Yoga is an ancient practice, and there's even some evidence of it being discovered in the Mohenjo-Daro, and
right.
But the tantric philosophy, the tantric exposition, really became began to be written out, codified around the 7th century, and really reached its strength in the 9th century. The beautiful thing about that was this: Shaivism as a tradition and as a philosophical exposition was not some theory that somebody wrote. It was centuries of internal practice, and these, what I call these inner scientists, discovering this understanding in themselves. And for centuries, of course, it would have been only transmitted orally, was not written down at all from guru to teacher, guru to student, sorry. But it really demonstrates that it was really the internal practice of turning within and discovering that within themselves, that these tantrics, that was their experience, and they began to share it first, of course, through oral transmission, and then through the written word. And so it really reached its strength in the 9th century, and from the 9th century through about the 13th century was really the prominent spiritual practice in India. It went underground after that because of the Muslim incursion. And then, of course, it kind of resurfaced really in the 19th, you know, in this century, and a lot of it resurfaced, you know, in Western culture. But the tantric practices, fundamentally, there are a few canons that you could think about that make the practice a tantric practice. Primarily is that it's a non-dualistic practice. The non-dualistic understanding that there is only God, there's only Shiva, and his emission, which is with the Shakti, and that all of life is held within that field of consciousness. Some of the more practical, down-to-earth, human ways that that expressed itself was that tantric practices also have no distinctions between men and women, for example. Of course, Orthodox practices at the time, women were not allowed to practice, and that was a big distinction. So women were allowed within practice. The eating of meat and drinking of wine and and having sex, which of course were considered not pure at the time, were part of were understood to be fine within the tantric practice. It wasn't like they just necessarily, well, let's all go have sex, let's drink a lot of wine. But what they were trying to really express was they were being told for a long time, you can't be pure, you can't know God and eat meat or drink wine or have sex. And these tantrics were doing all of those things and knowing God. And so it was a very inclusive tradition, and but coming from the fundamental canon that all of life is one thing. So how can you say this is good, this is bad, this is pure, this is not pure?
Got it. Thank you. That helps me understand. You know, on your personal website, you write, or someone writes about you that you are a renunciate, but a renunciate in a tantric way. And I think what you've just described perhaps helps me understand what that passage means to some extent. That is to say, it isn't about some particular set of rules that you are adhering to, but it is a spirit that you seek to serve, if you will. Is that fair?
And the reality is that the sannyasi order, there are a couple of different orders that grew in India. The Sarasvati order is probably the most prominent. Wasn't exactly a part of tantric practice. And sannyas, in its traditional sense, basically, there are different levels of sannyas, but that ultimately is the renunciation of the world, the renunciation of, it's ultimately even of family, the last, you know, stage of sannyas, is you leave your family, all these different things that happen within sannyas, whereas the tantrics, the title, if you will, the term was incorporated into the tantric practices, but always from the point of view of what we're surrendering is our limited self, and what we're surrendering is our unwillingness to serve God. And so from my own perspective, that was why it was important for me to, when I took sannyas, to, as an affirmation of the place that I was trying to live in, had been trying to live in. I only took sannyas about 10 years ago, but I've always felt for me that it was really that statement of unconditional surrender to serving God and the people that are the manifest expression of that.
So this is interesting to me, because when you say you did that 10 years ago, by looking at your life, having been a spiritual teacher and leading an ashram community, by all external markers, one would say that you had already surrendered your life. So, and given that in the tantric tradition, there isn't an external let's say, manifestation of like stopping eating meat or stopping drinking or anything or stopping sexual activity, what was the shift for you that came so late as 10 years ago that for you means renunciation?
Well, to be really honest with you, I had wanted to take sannyas for a long time, and the person that was my teacher, Chaitanananda, who was in charge of the ashram, for whatever reason, wasn't prepared to confer that title. And so it was about a year after I moved out of the ashram and moved to Berkeley that I took sannyas. And I actually, so I didn't take it from him, I took it from a swami who was a woman who lived in New York City. So because again, it was really my way of trying to affirm the way I had tried to live and serve for a long time. So that's the reason why it was so late in the game in that sense.
So in other words, for you, you felt like you had been embodying that sense of renunciation, but the official formality of it was something that came later.
Yeah, exactly.
Got
right.
It.
And, you know, I have to say, unfortunately, and particularly in the late 60s and early 70s, there were a number of situations where, hundreds, thousands of people took sannyas, right? I kind of scratch my head at it because I meet a lot of people who used to be swamis.
Mm-hmm.
And that I really scratch my head at. How do you offer your life to God and then decide that you're not going to do that anymore? But the point is that a lot of people, you know, it was, you know, let's put on the robe, let's wear the beads, let's you know, get a new name, etc. And while I'm sure many people were sincere and earnest in that and really grew from it, I think there was a lot of spiritual materialism that was going on there. And so, and classically, traditionally, you would only have been conferred sannyas by only another swami can do that, and generally by your teacher, and usually after years of ardent service and practice.
Got it. So, unfortunately, we're coming up to our break, so I don't think I'm going to be able to. You'll have time to answer the question I want that comes up for me in connection with this discussion we're just having now. About renunciation, but it seems to me that the way you and your tradition position Tantra is something that is very, at least potentially, very congruent with a lay lifestyle in the West. What people might think of as a lay lifestyle, as opposed to a monastic lifestyle. We haven't made that distinction in this discussion.
Right.
I don't know if that's one that makes sense in your tradition at all. Anyway, but what I'm saying is that in India, I think many renunciates would basically live off of charity entirely, depending on their level of renunciation, and that's not really as practical a thing to do in the West for people. And moreover, there's this thing about the whole point about women and the women being able to embody the tradition. So when we come back, I'm hoping that you'll be able to address some of these questions and how this works for contemporary 21st century Western people.
Okay, very good. I'd be happy to.
Excellent.
Great.
Well, right now we're going to take a short break at the hour. The time is 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS LP Cows Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Goodnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I are speaking this week with our guest by telephone, Swami Kacharanata, a teacher and leader of a community of spiritual practitioners at Sacred Space Yoga Sanctuary. He is a disciple of the beloved Swami Rudrananda and serves as director of Rudra Mandir in Berkeley, California, a center for spirituality and teaching. Cows Community Radio wishes to thank Advanced Security for their support. Advanced Security is a family-owned firm providing security and fire alarm systems. Please say that you were referred by Cows Radio. For information online, you can see advancedsecurity.us or call them at area code 707-544-9200. Cows Community Radio wants to thank the California Bluegrass Association for joining us as a supporter. The California Bluegrass Association has been dedicated to the preservation of bluegrass, gospel, and old-time music since 1975. The association sponsors concerts and music camps throughout California. For more information about CBA, please call 209-588-9214 or look for them on the web at www.cbaontheweb.org. West County Health Centers are celebrating National Health Centers Week at the Sebastopol Community Health Center Open House with our many friends and supporters. This year's theme is Celebrating America's Health Centers, Transforming Health Care in Our Local Communities. A silent auction and tours will be held at their facility, and the program for the evening will be held at 5:30 p.m. So this is happening from on August 9th. And it's the Sebastopol Community Health Center. For more information, you can contact them at www.wchealth.org. Just a reminder that Cows Community Radio is membership supported. All of our volunteers, programmers, DJs, all work on a volunteer basis, and we still have real operating needs to keep this station going. So help keep originally sourced West Sonoma County Radio live and on the air. Go to www.kows.fm to find out how you can join. We have various membership programs with thank you gifts associated with them and lots of ways that you can help support and become a member of the herd. We will return to our discussion after a short musical break. We'll be listening to Swara Mantra from the CD Ravi Shankar, Chants of India, produced by George Harrison.